September 23, 1918. A second message to the makers of public sentiment in Connecticut. Made in Connecticut. Interviews on the War. Issued by the Connecticut State Council of Defense, State Capitol, Hartford, Connecticut. Approved by the Committee on Public Information, 10 Jackson Place, Washington, D.C. Executive Order. I hereby create a Committee on Public Information to be composed of the Secretary of State, the Secretary of the War, the Secretary of the Navy, and a civilian who shall be charged with the executive direction of the committee. As civilian chairman of the committee, I appoint Mr. George Creel. The Secretary of State, the Secretary of War, and the Secretary of the Navy are authorized each to detail an officer or officers to work with the committee. Signed, Woodrow Wilson, April 14, 1917. The publication by the Connecticut State Council of Defense of this booklet of Made in Connecticut, Interviews on the World War, is approved by the Committee on Public Information. Signed, George Creel, Chairman. To the person receiving this bulletin. Several weeks ago, you received from the Connecticut State Council of Defense a communication similar to this, containing reprints of the President's Flag Day speech, the address of Elihu Rue to the Russian people, and the address of the American Rights League to the Russian people. They set forth with eloquence and fidelity to the facts America's position in the World War and the gravity of the crisis we are now facing. The call for this was so great that additional editions of the pamphlet were issued. In this second bulletin, you are given the views of citizens of your own state who have achieved the title to leadership of thought, or who are so associated with war work as to be able to speak with some degree of authority on the subject matter. These statements have been secured by the Connecticut State Council of Defense and published in the press under the general heading of Made in Connecticut War Interviews, and are here assembled and distributed to a selected mailing list. As was stated in the previous bulletin, this matter is sent to you because your position in the community is such that you are a maker of public sentiment. Will you please accept the personal responsibility of giving currency to these views insofar as they meet your approval? The Connecticut State Council of Defense, Marcus H. Holcomb, Governor, Richard M. Bissell, Chairman, Joseph W. Alsop, Winchester Bennett, D. Chester Brown, George M. Cole, Homer S. Cummings, Howard A. Giddings, Charles A. Goodwin, Julius Strumlaw, William R. Webster, Harris Whittemore.
Why We Are Fighting by Marcus H. Holcomb, Governor of Connecticut.
We are in this war for the same reason that we engaged in the Revolutionary War. You ask why the United States is engaged in the present war? For the same reason we engaged in the war of our revolution. Then, to establish our independence. Now, to preserve it. It was a long time before we were fully comprehended of the issues of this worldwide war, and realized that their determination would vitally affect us. The animosities between other nations did not interest our people, and we were reluctant to become involved in their disputes. We had disturbances on our southern boundary and were occupied with our own affairs, and in attempting to maintain a neutral position. It took 2 years of this war and a demonstration of German methods to clear our vision, during which period Germany and her allies have ignored every principle of international law, violated treaties at will, established zones of travel upon the high seas along which we were told we might travel, sunk our ships with submarines, and murdered our citizens. When we finally realized that the results of this war would decide whether the autocracy of Germany would dominate the world, or whether self-government should prevail and humanity survive. For centuries, many of the countries of the world have been struggling to establish self-government, which we call a democracy. The progress has been slow and frequently at the cost of war. But democracy has been slowly but surely winning its way. This country is perhaps the most conspicuous example of it. But England, France, Italy, and some other countries are in line. And Russia and China are struggling towards it. Democracy is bound to win because, notwithstanding its weaknesses, it tends to give the individual a decent chance. It makes the good of the individual the keynote and recognizes the rights and capacities of manhood. It is not perfect, but it marks the nearest approach to perfection that anybody has been able to formulate. Always in the struggle to make democracy effective, it has been opposed by the idea that a large part of the people must be subjugated to the will and well-being of a few, who dominate not because of their abilities or wisdom or goodness, but because of their inherited position in society, an idea which limits and restricts the activities of the individual and denies him his fundamental right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Unless curbed by democratic forms, such is the result of an autocratic government. And where a monarchy or empire there exists a military caste system to which even the civil authorities are subordinated, and which colors and directs the thoughts of those who rule, as is the case with Germany, the individual man must necessarily be deprived of many of his opportunities. The victory of Germany in this war means that an outworn system of society, which most of the world has been striving to throw off, will be perpetuated and extended. It means the victory of autocracy over democracy. And it means this not merely for Europe, but for us. If we should escape the actual domination of Germany, we would still be compelled, in pure self-defense, to maintain great armies and navies, to change our government into an effective military machine, and to treat with other countries upon the basis of armed duelists. That, to my mind, is the reason why we are fighting. Just as in the Revolutionary War, our forefathers fought England in order to win the chance to live in freedom. Just as the Civil War, many of our fathers died in the belief that they were struggling to extend and make permanent that freedom. So, we of today must bend every energy of body and mind to perpetuate and make safe that same freedom.
By Richard M. Bissell, Chairman, Connecticut State Council of Defense.
We are in this war because Prussian outrages and aspirations made it impossible to stay out of it. Why are we at war? That question is a strange one when we stop to consider the specific and wanton injuries and insults which were inflicted upon us by Germany and patiently borne during a period exceeding 2 years in duration. During this time, the armed forces of Germany murdered American citizens, sank American ships engaged in perfectly lawful undertakings, and made but vague and evasive replies to our demands for redress. When the language and tone of our protests became severe, assurances were given, but were promptly broken when Germany's plan of campaign made a resumption of her attacks upon us worthwhile in her eyes. Germany was at the same time actually plotting the dismemberment of this country. No nation with resources and power sufficient to defend its existence has ever so patiently and for so long a time maintained peace in the face of such continuous and unrequited insult and injury. The dealings of Germany with other countries, and the writings and spoken words of highly influential German officials and professors, have made it impossible to doubt that the German autocracy planned the economic and political mastery of the world. One well-known German writer before the Great War described openly the military steps to be taken in case Germany should wish to, quote, impose her will, unquote, upon America. Prior to our entrance in the Great War, evidences multiplied that the time had come when the free nations of the world must band together to fight for the ideals of democratic government. The time has come when the issue of the Great War was plainly whether an irresponsible autocracy should hold the civilized nations of the world in a state of virtual vassalage, or whether those nations and peoples to whom liberty is dear should put it forever beyond the power of that autocracy to carry out its plans for worldwide supremacy. No nation, great or small, it seems to me, ever took up the sword in a juster cause, or one where the issues were so important. We were slow to recognize the issues involved, and that our present allies for nearly 3 years were fighting our battles, the battle of all democracies. As we did not share in the early struggles and sacrifices of the war, our obligation is the more imperative now that we too have taken our place in the battle line. The result of the contest is by no means determined. As President Wilson has said, quote, "The enemy is balked, but not beaten," unquote. And he must be beaten if our ideals are to be preserved. The wastage of men and of resources in the countries of the Allies has been enormous. There is urgent need of every man, of every dollar, and of all the materials to which this country can furnish. We are distinctly a peace-loving people. But we must remember that the greater the effort, the sooner the peace of the right kind will become possible. He is no true lover of peace whose tardiness, lukewarmness, obstructiveness, or half-heartedness prolong the struggle. Every delay, every failure to measure up to the needs of the hour, means greater sacrifice of life and greater burdens of suffering and taxation. The men who have taken up arms to represent America in this war will do their utmost cheerfully and bravely. Nor can we doubt that ultimately they and the forces of our allies will succeed in securing for us and future generations of Americans peace and undisturbed right to pursue our career as a nation without fear of attempted foreign domination, if, but only if, the rest of our citizens, men and women alike, with an equally high spirit of devotion, give themselves to the task of supporting of men at the front with the sum total of the moral and material forces and resources of this country. At the request of the authorities at Washington, the Connecticut State Council of Defense, with its committee in every town in the state, has been appointed by the governor as the instrumentality through which the people of Connecticut may take part in this great task. It needs and solicits the aid and support of every Connecticut citizen.
By the Honorable Simeon E. Baldwin, former governor of Connecticut.
We are in the war because the sovereign will of the people, expressed through their chosen representatives, has so determined. Congress has declared in plain words why we are fighting. To Congress, the people of Connecticut and every other state have been committed, by the terms of the Constitution of the United States, the sole right of declaring war. It is made a legislative act, to be done only with the consent of both houses and the approval of the President. It is customary for nations, in declaring war, to state the reasons. We stated the reasons for the Revolutionary War in the Declaration of Independence. At the World's Peace Congress of substantially all civilized nations, held at The Hague in 1907, a treaty was signed on this subject. Later in 1909, the United States and the German Empire each ratified it, and it became the supreme law of this land. Article 1 reads thus. The contracting powers recognize that hostilities between themselves must not commence without previous and explicit warning, in the form either of a reasoned declaration of war or of an ultimatum with conditional declaration of war. Germany made no declaration of war against the United States. The United States has made a declaration of war against Germany, and it is worded thus. Joint resolution declaring that a state of war exists between the Imperial German government and the government and the people of the United States, and making provision to prosecute the same. Whereas the Imperial German government has committed repeated acts of war against the government and the people of the United States of America. Therefore be it resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States of America in Congress assembled, that the state of war between the United States and the Imperial German government which has thus been thrust upon the United States, is hereby formally declared, and that the President be, as he is hereby, authorized and directed to employ the entire naval and military forces of the United States and the resources of the government to carry on war against the Imperial German government, and to bring the conflict to a successful termination by all resources of the country, are hereby pledged by the Congress of the United States. Signed, Champ Clark, Speaker of the House of Representatives. Signed, Thomas R. Marshall, Vice President of the United States of America. Approved, April 6, 1917. Signed, Woodrow Wilson. Here is our sailing chart. It is official. It is clear. The United States is waging no war of aggression. Germany has committed repeated acts of war against us. She has thus thrust war upon us. Therefore, we declare that a state of war exists between her and us. This is the declaration of the whole people of the United States through their lawful representatives. This is why we are fighting. Congress had the right to speak, and it has spoken. Congress had the right to define our position, and it has defined it. It is not our business to look any farther into the causes of the war. Congress has done that for us. Our one duty now is to turn to and do all we can to win the war. By the Right Reverend Chauncey B. Brewster, Bishop of the Protestant Episcopal Diocese of Connecticut. This is a war to end war and to preserve ideals more sacred than life. Sometimes the only right way to make peace is by means of force against rampant and rapacious wrong. Such a time has now come. It is a supreme hour of history upon which wait great issues of humankind. It is a solemn hour for us, and especially for our young men. Here is high honor in bearing one's part in this momentous contest, this war to end war, to enthrone above the nations righteousness, to secure liberties that have been at such cost won, to ensure the coming generations from the menace of like wanton aggression and ruthless wrong. You ask me why we are fighting? Not for vengeance or territory. We go to war because the course of the German government was, in the words of our president, nothing less than war. Orders were given how we should sail the open seas. Ships that disobeyed were to be sunk. This was really a declaration of war. And to drown citizens sailing under the American flag was to make war. No self-respecting people could submit. The only alternative was to fight. We are at war because of overt hostile acts of the German government. That government has shown itself bent upon war with sinister purpose. The predatory Prussian power, in its unprovoked invasions, its atrocious deportations, its massacres on land and sea, and all its brutal procedure, has made war upon humanity. Neutrality had become impossible, because more and more evidently the war had become a paramount moral issue, plainer than any in history. It is a war precipitated and wantonly waged by irresponsible autocratic power to secure domination on the avowed principle that might makes right. Thus, we are fighting not only in self-defense against unwarranted aggression, but moreover for ideals more sacred than life and worthy of utmost sacrifice. This is a struggle of the free peoples against the Turco-Teutonic autocracies. Upon us has been forced a part in the conflict. The Allies have been fighting our battles. It was time for us to take our place beside them. If we do not fight beside them now, later by ourselves alone, we should have to fight the same unscrupulous foe. Horrible as war is, there is something worse than war. In the day when humanity is threatened by monstrous wrong, the hour has struck that summons the civilization that has slowly built up through the centuries to take up arms on behalf of good faith and law between nations, the rights of the small and the weak against the mighty, and to fight for the best things achieved by mankind.
by Lieutenant Governor Clifford B. Wilson, Mayor of Bridgeport.
We are in this war not only for ourselves and our allies, but for the German people themselves. To those of this country who are in a position to participate in the world struggle comes a peculiar opportunity. The cause of the Allies must be successful not only for them, but for their peoples, but for the welfare of the German people themselves. The time has come when the people of the whole civilized world must be given the right to legislate for and govern themselves. This unprecedented war is one for principle, a clash between the old order of the divine rights of kings and the enlightened system of government of, for, and by the governed. This country, through its 140 years of progress under this latter form, has proven conclusively that such a government can endure. It is the duty and peculiar privilege of this nation to lend its force to the accomplishment of the high principles of a democracy, and to assist in the establishing of the equality of man throughout the world. We must and will protect our own land. However, our larger opportunity is to mankind in general. Imbued with the unusual opportunity which is presented to us, I believe that the American people will avail themselves of this worthy service and bring added luster to their country, themselves, and the splendid traditions of the United States.
By Mrs. Rose F. Hartshorn of New London, speaking officially for the New London County Auxiliary Committee.
A woman's viewpoint. We are in the war because Germany made war on us. We are fighting because Germany has forced America, as she has forced the rest of the world, to defend herself in the only way possible against a nation who has been participating for 40 years to carry on a policy of economic and political expansion by means of war. We did not make war on Germany. Germany made war on us by taking the lives of our citizens on the high seas, by disputing our rights to be a free and independent nation, by forcing us to submit to her regulations of our commerce by means of unrestricted submarine warfare, by placing spies within our country to help the German Empire destroy our inner peace by fomenting strikes, bomb outrages, etc., by plotting through her ambassador in Washington while she pretended friendship for us to bribe and incite Japan and Mexico to war against us. Her replies to all our protests against these outrages have been little less than insults. So, to protect our national honor and integrity, we have been forced to declare war against Germany. We have not been drawn into this war by capitalism, commercialism, or national policy, but by the leaders of a nation who have tried deliberately for years to make war on America, taking our good nature for cowardice, and our lack of preparedness for a lack of national self-respect. In short, we are fighting for self-protection, to preserve our own democracy, and to make sure that government of the people, by the people, and for the people, shall triumph and drive consciousless military autocracy from the earth, thereby bringing everlasting world peace.
By Dudley L. Vale, Chairman, Litchfield County Auxiliary Committee.
We have entered the war to secure a permanent peace instead of a mere truce. If there is one thing more than another that the whole world wants passionately, it is assurance that the peace which will someday succeed this tremendous war shall be durable and permanent, not a mere truce. And the first and most necessary step toward that goal is the thorough defeat of Germany. She has spent her energies for years in plotting and preparing for the subjugation of other nations, and it must be made clear beyond mistake that any such attempts are futile if the peace that is won is to endure. This is an immense undertaking, but no one doubts that it will be accomplished, and every man who wears the uniform of the American Army or Navy will have the satisfaction of knowing that he is doing a man's work to make sure that the world hereafter will be a fit place to live in for our descendants and for all peoples. It has not been so in the past for most of the peoples of Europe, though we have enjoyed comparative immunity because of our geographical remoteness. They have lived and labored under a burden of military expenditure that has meant crushing taxation, and they have lived in constant fear of sudden aggression from a powerful neighbor, a fear which the outbreak of war 3 years ago more than justified. We have been spared that fear, chiefly because we had no realization of our danger. But now that the German imperialism has given so plain a demonstration of its purposes and plans and methods, we should thereafter share the dread of the unprovoked assault at any time if Germany were able to secure peace before she was soundly beaten. We should have to live as armed as the nations of Europe were armed, in continual fear of sudden attack. It is this condition of things that the world is banded together to end. And to bring to an end requires that the foremost military power in the world must go down in military defeat. There is no overestimating what this means. It will require the exertion of every bit of power this country can summon, the devotion of every available man and every dollar. It will require for our generation an appalling sacrifice, but one for a worthy and notable object, the future peace of the world. This should mean much to the heart and conscience of every man who serves in the army, or in any capacity, for each one may feel that he is devoting himself to a mighty enterprise, whose outcome will be a better United States to live in, and a better world, too, than the past has ever known.
By Edward P. Jones of Winsted, President of the Connecticut Chamber of Commerce.
We have entered the war to determine the subsequent course of history. At different times during the history of the world, wars have been fought which have determined the destinies not only of nations, but of courses of civilization. They have determined whether races should be Oriental or Occidental, pagan or Christian. Other wars have affected either a single nation or a group of nations. The Revolutionary War affected directly only the United States and England, but it established the principle of liberty. The Civil War affected only this country, but it declared to the world that the principles of freedom, that one man could not be made the slave of another. The present World War will, I believe, establish the democracy of nations. Bandits have had their day and are gone. Pirates have sailed the seas and have disappeared. Germany at the present time is a bandit and a pirate among the nations. This war will determine that nations, as well as individuals, have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It will determine that a treaty is a treaty and not a scrap of paper. It is the privilege of the United States, the oldest, the richest, the most powerful exponent of democracy, to throw the weight of her power in favor of the democracy of the world and the liberty of all peoples. As our sons turn their faces toward the battlefields of Europe, let us inspire them with the belief that their sacrifice will not only preserve us, the liberty we inherited from our fathers, but make safe for the weaker nations the same liberty we enjoy. Let us not bid them adieu with tear-stained eyes, but with courage, faith, and hope let us send them to the emancipation of the world. When they have departed, we should remember that there is a food line as well as a fighting line, that there is service at home as well as service abroad. It is the duty of every man, woman, and child to support the government in its determination to arm, equip, and support the American Army. To do this, it will become necessary for us to give up some things we now enjoy. Like the Minutemen of the Revolutionary War, when 20,000 members of the Connecticut Chamber of Commerce stand ready at a moment's notice to save, sacrifice, and serve in any way which will assist America and her allies in winning this great war, establishing permanent peace.
The Perils of Failure by Arthur T. Hadley, President of Yale University.
If we fail to win this war, the result will be a series of wars. President Hadley's interest in the cause is more than academic. He has furnished to the service two sons, Major Morris Hadley of the Field Artillery and Lieutenant Hamilton Hadley of the Signal Corps. What is likely to happen if we fail to win this war? Was the significant question put to President Hadley. A series of wars, was his prompt reply, begun without notice and waged with much disregard for the rights of noncombatants. When asked for his grounds of this opinion, he continued, "Because leading men in Germany believe that war is a good thing for their country and for the world, and should be conducted without scruple when the interests of Germany seem to require it." He was asked, "Do the German people in general share this view?" His reply was, "Not entirely, but the German people in general are so patriotic that they are content to do what the military leaders wish and believe what the military leaders say, so long as it brings them victory." When asked if the warlike spirit of Germany continues a direct menace to America, President Hadley's reply was unequivocally in the affirmative. "Yes," he said, "we know that the German Secret Service has been active in America, and that the German government in time of peace suggested that the Mexican army should be used to invade the United States." His questioner suggested, "But does not our distance from Europe protect us?" "No. Modern improvements have made the Atlantic Ocean very much less protection today than it was 10 years ago. And if progress of invention continues, 10 years hence, it may be no protection at all." "Can we not protect ourselves by treaties?" "Not unless the result of the war leads the Germans to see that treaty breakers are punished, that the apparent advantage gained by the invasion of Belgium is purchased at the price of ultimate defeat."
By Charles Seymour of the Department of History at Yale University.
If we fail to win, the result will be the consolidation of a pan-Germanic empire, the invasion of America, and the attempted establishment of a world Germanic empire. If we fail to win this war, we must, frankly, face two inevitable consequences, both pregnant with disaster for the happiness of our own and coming generations. The one consequence is material, the other moral. Our failure means the triumph of the militaristic clique at Berlin and the assurance of power to the pan-Germans who believe that God has given to Germany the function of ruling the world. Germany will be ruled by such men as the Crown Prince, who pilfers chateaux and sends millions to their death on the field, in the hope of winning personal glory. As von Hindenburg, the personification of brutal, efficient militarism. As von Tirpitz, who inaugurated the policy of drowning noncombatant women and children by the hundreds. Can we trust the peace of the world to such men? If we fail to win the war, they will, at the very moment of peace, dominate an empire such as the world has not yet seen since the days of Rome. Germany was strong in 1914. Her strength will be quadrupled if she is allowed to maintain that union of Central Europe which she has been building up these last 3 years. It will not simply be Germany the world needs fear, but Germany, Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, and the waterways of the Rhine and the Danube, the bridge into Asia at Constantinople, and the shortcut to the east. The empire would be self-contained. It would have its mines in Alsace and Belgium, its oil and wheat fields in Romania. It would draw inexhaustible supplies from Mesopotamia. The new empire would be far stronger in relation to the rest of the world than ever Germany was. Its foes would be divided by their failure. Italy, France, and Great Britain would be laying the blame for the disaster on the shoulder of the other. Russia, torn by internal anarchy, would be Germany's vassal. The war has cost Germany far less than her opponents, partly because she prepared for it when costs were low, partly because her boundaries have remained practically inviolate. She owes no money except to her own people. The British mercantile marine has suffered terrible losses. The new empire of Central Europe, armed with the submarine, would threaten to control not merely the land, but the seas as well. Dominating Europe, always seeking new markets, how long would it be before the triumphant Pan-Germans reached across the Atlantic for the rich and unexploited territories of the Americas? And would they pay more attention to the Monroe Doctrine than they did to their own people to respect Belgian neutrality? If we fail to win this war, there will be another and a worse consequence. For our failure will signify the triumph of brute force as opposed to justice. The authorities, which in cold blood command the devastation of France and Belgium, the torture of children, the rape of women, the murder of Red Cross nurses, will have gone unpunished. The doctrine that might makes right will have been justified. We must not fail to win this war.
Our Duty to Our Allies by Arthur L. Shipman of Hartford, Chairman, Hartford County Auxiliary Committee.
It would be impossible and shameful merely to stand on the side and protect our own ocean routes. We must give all our resources of money, men, material, and food without stint. What have the Allies a right to expect from the United States? To put the question in another form, and one which is frequently asked nowadays, what are we in this war for, anyhow? Two undeniable facts furnish the answer. First, the ocean and its seas, the highways of travel and commerce, free to all neutrals, were forbidden us by the German Empire. Second, that prohibition was enforced against our protests by one of the meanest as well as one of the most cruel devices, the submarine. We had, therefore, to fight for our rights. It is of little consequence that this is only one of the reasons, and perhaps not the most important reason, why we are at war. No one can deny, however, that Germany's prohibition of our use of the seas is the most immediate and direct cause of our being in the struggle. Suppose, then, that such were the only reasons. Our duty, it might be said, was thereby limited to clearing for safe travel the ocean's highways by use of our naval forces, and there is where we should stop. But have our Allies only the right to expect of us police protection for our own carrying trade? Let us see what that involves. Our goods are carried in many other vessels besides those that fly our country's flag. We cannot protect our goods en route without protecting the vessel that contains them, whether British, Dutch, Norwegian, or French. The moment one of our guns is fired to protect a British merchantman carrying our goods, we are in effect fighting on British soil to defend it from invasion. But no one can put any limit on his lawful efforts in a fight. If one goes in at all, one must go in all over. This is true not only from the point of view of the spectator, but from the points of view of our opponents, our allies, and ourselves. Suppose that we could quiet our own sense of shame by standing on the outskirts and protecting only the avenues of commerce, although that would be an impossible position for America with its history and traditions to occupy. Surely the onlookers and our children would put themselves in the position of our allies and say, whatever America has of resources, money, men, supplies, materials, food, should be used without stint for our support. Men, women, and children are suffering untold losses in body, mind, and spirit from the war, and especially from the kind of warfare which is being waged by the Central Powers. It therefore behooves every one of us, and by us I mean every man, woman, child that makes up America, to contribute all in his power to fight our fight, that is, the fight of ourselves and our allies. Mark you, that in what I have said, we are putting aside all higher duty, our duty to humanity, our duty to save or help save the world as a proper place for us and for them to live and die in. This conclusion is placed upon the lowest possible ground, viz., the duty of everyone who enters any contest, the mere animal obligation toward one's fellows in a fight.
By Joseph G. Kitchell, representing the Middlesex County Auxiliary Committee.
Men and money are what we owe to our allies. This analysis of the situation coming from the father of a son about to embark for France with the 165th Infantry is sincere and critical. We must send men as well as money, because both are indispensable to win the war. And at this juncture, only the United States can respond adequately to both needs. Men and money are economic commodities, and as life and property are the most valuable and best guarded of mortal assets, what greater asset could be asked or given? Money may be the sinews of war, but sinews are impotent without vitalized energy. In the end, manpower must cope with manpower for manpower. Shall we save our economic commodities only to lose, or shall we expend in order to keep? A dollar merely saved is a dollar retired, unless expended to advantage. A life saved for the mere continuance of one's present state of consciousness is a retired currency. The buried talent of either unit of usefulness, whether life or property, has been condemned since the lesson in the Master's parable. A fund or a life well applied may conceivably be exalted a thousandfold in this struggle of the right over wrong, and that is why our lives and our fortunes should be at the investment disposal of the nation, to battle for all that our republic stands for, and against the misguided aims of Prussianism, with its crimson list of glorified crimes justified by a distorted intellectualism. And so, it is a grave, dear duty to speed our soldier boys under the banner of the great cause, and to back them with all that we have.
By the Honorable Martin Scully, Mayor of Waterbury.
We should pay France the debt of liberty incurred in the Revolutionary War. We are in the war because we have placed honor above a peace unworthy of the history and traditions of our country. We enter upon the war solemnly, fully appreciating the magnitude of the task, but with a fixed determination to ultimately succeed. Our allied enemies are particularly situated in that they occupy contiguous territory and are thereby enabled to shift troops from front to front without much delay. America and its allies, on the other hand, are scattered around a large circle and must necessarily maintain a sufficient number of men to meet every emergency on the various fronts. It is apparent, therefore, to every thinking mind that America must send a large and thoroughly equipped army in order that we may not have humiliating and painful reports, such as shocked England as a result of the disastrous campaigns in Mesopotamia and Gallipoli. It is only a few years ago since ex-Governor Simeon E. Baldwin unveiled a monument in this city to the memory of three members of Rochambeau's army who died while en route to join Washington at Yorktown. France sent 5,000 of her bravest soldiers to this country during the Revolutionary War, who turned the tide of defeat into a glorious victory for America. After we had achieved our independence, we entered into a treaty with France, by the terms of which it was agreed that every other nation, even England, could trade with us on equal terms. France, who came to us in our distress, refused to take any advantage to herself because of the assistance which she gave us. The bread which she cast upon the waters at that time now bids fair to return a hundredfold. Let the young men of this country respond to the sentiments of freedom and democracy with that same enthusiasm that inspired the 19-year-old Lafayette, who offered his service to Washington either as a commissioned officer or as a private in the ranks without pay. In this way, we can, in a measure, repay the Republic of France and bring about the happy consummation so earnestly urged by President Wilson, that every nation, large and small, shall enjoy the right to choose its own sovereignty.
The Fairness of the Draft, by ex-State Senator Joseph W. Alsop, member of the Connecticut State Council of Defense.
We raise our army by selective draft because it is the only truly democratic method. The benefits of our government and the responsibilities for its carrying on should fall alike on all. The first duty of every person to our country is to protect home and family and to sustain the form of government to save which this war is on part being waged. In former days, wars were fought by only a small part of the population, but now modern war is, or should be, waged by the whole population. Each man, woman, and child has his or her part in the burden to bear and must share in the war and its results. When we fight, we must fight with our whole power and energy, or else we shall fail. To each individual, there must be the task assigned for which that individual is best adapted. In times of peace, we enjoy in this land of ours unexampled benefits and protection of our individual rights. We say we are Americans, that we belong to the United States of America. We should remember the responsibilities which these words carry with them. War has come and our government has stepped in and is engaged in the task of organizing our people and our resources to meet the emergency. To our men of fighting age must fall the burden of carrying arms. Each man fitted to do so must do his share. None shall be excused on account of position, family, or wealth. None shall be excused who wish to dodge their duty to their country. Only those shall be excused who are indispensable to the task of organizing our resources, or those whose absence from their usual daily tasks would throw too great an economic burden on their dependents. Therefore, we have the selective draft, so-called. It is a measure founded on the very principles on which democracy is founded. Those selected under it to carry arms in defense of our country should be regarded not only by themselves, but by all others, as men chosen for the highest duty to which a citizen can be called.
By the Honorable Joseph A. Cook, Mayor of Meriden.
The selective draft secures a square deal for all. The method used in the present war draft is among the best that could be chosen. There was no opportunity for favoritism, and all were given a fair chance. Sons of wealthy parents, as well as those not so well supplied with this world's goods, were drafted, and they have to serve their country, except there be some good reason for exemption. In fact, young men will be taken from all walks of life. Thus, the duty is distributed as equally as possible. The fairness shown in drawing the draft numbers in Washington has created confidence in the young men that they will be given a square deal all around by the government. Many of them are not only willing but also anxious to enter the service that they may assist in the fight to continue the freedom we now enjoy. As our country is engaged in the great European conflict, we must fight to the end. There can be no backing out. To do this, the government must have the loyal support of her citizens. Undoubtedly, this will be given liberally, and American patriotism will, now as before, stand out as the greatest in the world.
By the Honorable Ellen L. Brown, Mayor of Norwich.
The government, and not the individual, should judge who should fight at the front. One of the greatest and the wisest pieces of constructive lawmaking passed by Congress in this time of war was consummated when the bill providing for selective draft became a law. It was conclusive proof that our lawmakers at Washington had learned at least one great lesson from the history of the war, which is taking place on the other side of the Atlantic. England, by bitter experience, had learned the lesson which the United States could profit by without the sacrifice so expensive to her ally in this matter. The fairness, value, and efficiency of this law as adopted are self-evident propositions. But be everything else as it may, one great question has to be answered at this time is, what is the value of this law to the United States as a country? As has been well said, we have become too prone to ask, what can our country do for us? When we should be asking, what can we do for our country? Now, we have come to see the justice of the latter proposition. And when one does get this point of view, he automatically realizes the value of the selective draft law. To be of greatest service to our country as individuals, we must be put into that place where we will be most useful in helping to carry the war to a successful conclusion. The system of raising all our armies by volunteering can never accomplish this result. The man most anxious to go to the front, and so the first volunteer, may be the one most needed to stay home and attend to some duties there, and so should be the last to volunteer. The government, and not the individual, should judge which should be the one to be sent to the front and which should be the one to attend to other duties at home or in other auxiliary branches of service. When his country calls a man to do his duty, applying a fair and equitable general principle in the selection of that man, he should be glad to obey his country's bidding, for he can then go, knowing that he is doing the most he can possibly for his country, to which he owes even his life if it need be.
By George B. Chandler, Chairman of the Committee on Publicity, Connecticut State Council of Defense.
The young man is drafted to serve his country to discharge the debt that he owes his country. Young man, your country has laid its heavy hand upon you and bade you go out and fight. Why is it that you, a member of a free people, can thus be drafted into war without your will or consent? For that same reason, that property of a free people is drafted for taxes, because it is necessary for national existence. Property is drafted every year. Manhood may not be drafted more than once in 100 years, but the principle involved in the two processes is exactly the same. A nation cannot live without taxes. It has to have funds to carry on its affairs. Neither can a nation live, in the present state of the world at least, without fighting. It cannot stay at one side, mind its own business, and be let alone. Belgium tried it, and she has been assassinated. For 2.5 years, the United States tried it and submitted to a series of affronts, outrages, and murders such as no first-class power has endured in modern history. The time comes when a nation must fight or perish. Do you owe anything to your country that gives it a moral right to order you into battle? Let us see. Your country protects your life. If you are assaulted on the street, a policeman comes to your rescue. If you are attacked on the high seas by a submarine while going on your own business, where you have a right to go, your country goes to war for you. Your country protects your property. If a robber breaks into your home, the forces of the state seek to locate him and punish him. If a fire breaks out in your city, the fire department comes to your aid. If a man tries to deprive you of what you have earned or saved, the courts of your country are open to you. Your country protects your family. While you are at your bench or desk, your mother, wife, sister, or children are being watched over by the state. When they go upon the streets or highways, or other proper places, the law and its agents say that they shall be protected, and you feel safe because you know it. Your country takes care of the unfortunate. If one of your family becomes insane, the state provides an institution for his care. If one of your relatives becomes poor and you cannot take care for him, the state does it for you. Your country educates you. If you wish to use them, your country provides schools from public funds. If you wish to be educated in private or church schools, the state charters or safeguards them. Your country makes civilization possible. By building or chartering roads for men to travel on and to transport goods over, by establishing courts of justice, by chartering endowed colleges, libraries and art museums, by establishing ambassadorships and consulates, entering into treaties and endeavoring to live on a plane of friendship with every nation that is willing to be friendly with it. That is what civilization means. Young man, you can't be a citizen of this country and a pro-German at the same time when your country is at war with Germany. It isn't Germany that has been protecting you in your rights. Germany hasn't been doing all of these things for you. It is your own nation, America. If you accept this protection from the United States and then give your heart to some other country, you are a cheat or an ingrate. Those who ride in the boat must pull an oar or jump out. If you didn't like the boat, you didn't have to get into it. The same principle applies to England haters. England, France, and the other allies are all trying to weather the storm. The craft have been lashed together. If you didn't intend to submit to majority rule of the crew under the command of duly elected officers, you should never have put out to sea on the old USA. There is nothing fine-spun or philosophical about this. It is just everyday honesty, ordinary decency, and plain common sense. Your country drafts you because it has a legal and moral right to. You have no legal or moral right to hang back or sulk or dodge. You can't talk back to Uncle Sam at this stage of the game. A nation at war is not a debating club. It is grim business, an organized people fighting for its life. The rules are laid down. The gong has rung. The play is called. The teams are on the field. Play your part like a sportsman and thoroughbred, as well as an American.
The Call to Young Manhood by the Right Reverend John J. Nyland, Doctor of Divinity, Bishop of the Diocese of Hartford of the Roman Catholic Church.
All authority is from God, and submission to lawful superiors is obedience to His will. The call of the hour is sacrifice. The call of the hour to the young men of America comes from the highest authority. As all the authority is from God, submission to lawful superiors is obedience to His will. The chief magistrate of the republic is such by the choice of the people, and so marked is the distinction between the man and the office, it would seem that in times of great crisis his party affiliation, his personality, his very name should be forgotten. He is the president. The hour is fraught with grave possibilities. The die is cast. The fate of the country rests upon the loyalty of its citizens. The commander-in-chief summons the nation to war. The young and the vigorous naturally should be the first to hearken to the summons, and bravely, eagerly, and with determination, hasten to present a sturdy front to the foe. We may put the words of his illustrious predecessor of 20 years ago in the mouth of the president. We love peace, but when we go to war, we send to the field the best and the bravest of the country. The best are those whom the love of God compels to keep His law. Edmund Burke has said, "I never knew a man that was bad who was fit for service that was good." The call of the hour is sacrifice. Let it begin with that self-restraint which makes the lower passions slaves and reason master. Let the soldier be persuaded that virtue is the blood of heroes. Sin is the virus of cowards. There are dangers to the youth of our country, more to be dreaded than the shrieking shrapnel. Worse than the most malignant disease of the body is wounding of the soul. Foolhardiness is folly, not bravery. Seeing the point from which the attack is liable to come and taking precautions accordingly is good military tactics. Removed from the influence of home and far from the restraints of friendly counsel, there will be great danger to the morals of the soldier. It will lurk in the vicinity of camps and sulk in the rear of the trenches. Strong drink and the wiles of corrupt women may rob him of honor and his country of a loyal defender. Honor, pride, self-confidence go down easily before persistent attacks of sensuality. The noblest aspirations of the soul are needed to save the soldier from himself. The constant sense of the presence of God and the ambition of an eternal reward are his only defense. Faith will animate and elevate manliness. Religion will intensify and consecrate patriotism. The youth of clean mind and fervent soul will bring honor to the cause he was sent to defend. In time of danger, there will be no flinching. Not brutal instinct, but patriotism nerves his arms. He fears no danger in whom the fear of God is uppermost. America calls her loyal sons to service. As in days past, she will undoubtedly be cheered by the ready and hearty response of the bravest and the best. Some of her defenders will fall on the field of honor. Many will return, hardened with toil, chastened by suffering, perhaps with limbs mutilated in the cruel strife, but intact. Let us hope in those virtues which go to make up the virile manhood and an unconquerable nation.
By the Honorable John H. Perry of Southport.
Be strong and endure hardness. To be a soldier of one's country when her existence is at stake is the highest form of earthly service. You ask me what, as I look at it, is the call of the hour to the young men of America. The hour seems to me to have but one call, and that so loud and clear and constant that every young man, consciously or subconsciously, must have heard it. The substance is always the same. To different ears, the details may seem to vary. I wonder whether my interpretation will help or hinder its force. In the composite of the thing we call our country, the young men stand for strength. The Bible tells us that messages which exhort to worthwhile living may well be sent to young men because they are strong. Therefore, times which peculiarly call for sturdy doing and brave enduring are the times for them. In this soulless maelstrom of lawful frightfulness, which Germany started 3 years ago and desires to continue and extend until most of the civilized world is drawn into her maw, America is now plainly seen to have a peril and a part as vital as that of England or France. To avert that peril and perform that part, much planning, much production, much self-denial, and much training are all indispensable. But only so, because without them, effective fighting cannot be done. And fighting is the only thing which ultimately counts. Absolutely the only thing which will now make America safe for Americans. It is the consummation of all of the services which all her citizens at such a time can render, and therefore it is the crown of all, and is the privilege, if not the prerogative, of her youth. To be a good soldier for one's country when her existence is at issue is the highest type of earthly service, but the capacity to endure hardness, it is its price, and the young men alone can pay it.
The Medical Aspect by Dr. C.C. Godfrey of Bridgeport, Chairman, Committee on Sanitation and Medicine, Connecticut State Council of Defense.
We must avoid England's blunder of sending young surgeons into the ranks and depleting the staffs of hospitals and medical schools. At the beginning of the war, England called into service a large number of her best surgeons and enlisted the able-bodied men from the Corps of Medical Students for service in the Army. This was done with the one object of caring for the Army needs, and without proper consideration of the many other objects which require medical skill. For it is just as essential that medical men should care for the civil as it is that they care for the military requirements. Depleting the hospitals and sparsely settled portions of the country of medical men and the medical schools of their faculties and students soon brought about a condition where needed medical aid could not be had. This may not have seemed so serious at the time, in the light that it was generally believed in England that the war would not last a year, and when the statement of Lord Kitchener as to a 3 years' duration was ridiculed. It has resulted, however, in having every available man called to the colors, and has caused great confusion in the filling of medical offices with competent men, as well as producing great hardships in portions of the United Kingdom from a lack of physicians, and placing a great burden on the older and disabled members of the profession unfitted for military service. The Council of National Defense at Washington very wisely determined at the start on what might be termed a selective volunteer system, by which each hospital was asked to indicate how many of its staff could be spared and yet be capable of thorough and efficient work. It was determined that no intern should be taken until he had completed a year's work in some hospital, thus ensuring more thoroughly trained men for the medical officers' corps, and at the same time not interfering with the normal running of the hospitals. That the faculties of our medical schools should not be depleted so as to prevent the carrying on of their work, and medical students should be urged to continue their studies. That medical men in isolated districts, where their loss would mean a hardship to the surrounding community, should not be called. With such provision, it is certain that neither our military nor civil population will suffer from lack of adequate medical attention.
A Manufacturer's View by Richard H. M. Robinson of Bridgeport, former member of the Connecticut State Council of Defense, now in service of Federal Shipping Board.
Our motives are stated by the President. The selective draft is both democratic and efficient. The call to young men is to serve where they fit best. Troops must be placed in France as early and as fast as possible. The reason for our entry into the war cannot be told in any clearer manner than it was in President Wilson's address to Congress, when he asked that a state of war be declared to exist with Germany. If there is any American who has not read that address, or his answer to that question, he owes it to himself and his country to do it. Why do we raise our army by selective conscription, you ask? We raise our army by selective conscription in order that the duties to be performed may be equitably distributed, as it is but right in a democracy, where the duties and privileges are uniform. Selective conscription consists, as I understand it, of choosing for military duty all those, irrespective of rank and conditions in life, who are within the determined age limit and whose physical fitness justifies their doing such duty. There is no favoritism, and all have an equal share in the duties of citizenship. Great Britain, at the outset of the war, relied solely upon voluntary enlistments, with the results that a great number of men qualified in particular trades volunteered for military service, when by the exercise of selective conscription, with proper examination, they would have been retained at home, where their duties were more valuable on account of their special qualifications. The call of the hour to the young men of America is to serve the needs of their country in such a manner as will best forward her interest at this time of national emergency. Those who have a special qualification along special lines may do well to do so by following those lines, provided they contribute to the military strength of the country. But those who have not, and this includes the greater number of young men, must serve the colors. The manpower of France has been seriously drained during the last 3 years, and it is understood that without replenishment from other countries such as ours, the cause for democracy as represented by the Allies would be jeopardized.
Our Cause by Homer S. Cummings of Stamford, member of the Connecticut State Council of Defense.
Our cause is our honor, our safety, and the perpetuity of our institutions. It is a war against war. There is no room for the debater, the doubter, the slacker, or the coward. Our country has undertaken the greatest and most critical task in history. The issue involves not only our honor, our safety, and the perpetuity of our institutions, but it also concerns the political freedom of the world, and by the same token, the happiness and progress of mankind. Preparation is going forward with great energy. Intelligent and disinterested men and women are everywhere at work, and the patriotism, fidelity, and skill of our soldiers, our sailors, and our leaders cannot be doubted. Great undertakings are afoot here and across the seas, the likes of which our people have never before contemplated. All this involves self-sacrifice in every field of endeavor, in every shop, on every farm, and in every home. There is work for everyone, and later there will be still more work. Heartbreaking, soul-searching, unremitting work. There is no room anywhere for the doubter, the debater, the slacker, or the coward. There is no room for anyone except patriots. Either we shall win this war, or our country will be humiliated and dishonored, and all the things that make life sweet and a nation proud will be polluted and soiled. Our flag has cost so much in blood and toil, and means so much to us, and to the stricken and the despoiled peoples of the world, that we cannot permit it to be trailed in the dust of defeat. May the good God give us strength and courage for this ordeal. It is a war against war, against hereditary power, and for all the cruel things that have menaced mankind from the beginning. It is the supreme effort and the final test of democracy. Failure is not to be thought of. The world will not slip back into barbarism, into a heartless feudalism made terrible by applied science. The cause for which we contend is sacred as right and justice and honor, and humanity and charity are sacred. We have the sanction of our national conscience, the approval of enlightened contemporary opinion, and we are fearless of the verdict of history. Those who in this hour serve America serve humanity. It is the highest and noblest cause to which we have ever been summoned.